Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Coming up on today's show, we'll hear about a significant discovery made by archaeologists led by UC researchers. But first, during Cincinnati's struggle with the heroin epidemic, there's been a lot of reporting about those who are addicted, treatment centers, statistics, and police work. But rarely has the focus been on the loved ones, parents, spouses, close friends, and children who also suffer. There's a fine line between these individuals helping or enabling, and their relationship can often become codependent and harmful. Joining us to discuss how to effectively help someone who's addicted are assistant professor in the Addiction Sciences Division of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience at the UC College of Medicine, Dr. Latrice Montgomery, president and CEO of Central Clinic Behavioral Health, Dr. Walter Smitson, and John, who wishes to remain anonymous, he's a member of a local Naranon program, and his son is a former addict. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Latrice, Walter, and John, thank you for being here this afternoon.
Thank you for having
thank
us.
You. Thank you.
John, you have lived through this with your youngest son being an addict. So how difficult is this to go through? What is it like for families who have an addict?
Well, it really is an emotional roller coaster. You know, when you find out that there's something going on, my first response was, this isn't really happening. I was living in denial. Then I moved into anger. Then I moved into embarrassment. You know, a lot of us are embarrassed that our child is an addict, and we don't know what to do. And we found support through a group called Naranon, which helps us deal with living with an addict, and we learn things like it's not our fault. We learn things like helping is a fine line. When an addict is in active addiction, they don't understand love. They don't understand. All they want to do is use. But our parental instincts or our spousal instincts are we have to buffer the pain. You know, we don't want to see our loved ones in pain. But what we find is an addict is driven by an instinctive desire to use. It's unbelievable. But what we do is we worry. We worried ourselves physically, emotionally, and spiritually sick. And society in general, supports that. You know, if you're at a location, somebody finds out you have an addict, you're looked at differently. If your child is put in jail for something they've done, society says, get them out of there. They don't need to be in there. But, you know, what we've learned is, you know, if the addict is going to decide to use, then they need to suffer the consequences of their choices. And it wasn't my fault. It wasn't because I was a bad father. It wasn't because I was a bad parent. My son has a disease called addiction. He didn't ask for it. I didn't ask him to have it either. But it is. So how do I learn to live my life with not having that guilt, and then the next phase, the fear of losing my son to the disease of addiction. It's a rough go.
And like you described it, it's a roller coaster ride. How old was he when he?
Well, when he first addicted? Found him using, he was 17, but he had been experimenting earlier than that. But the wheels really started to fall off. You know, he told us he's been clean for 4 years now, so he's able to share some of the perspectives that he's had. And he said that he entered his senior summer that, hey, I get to get high every day. And then by the end of the summer, it was, I don't think I can live a minute without being high. There was definitely a brain switch that changed. So the choice for him of not using is much different than any other person that's not an addict. But there again, I thought I could rush in there and fix him. I lost work. I isolated. I didn't want to go out. I was embarrassed. Facebook is a terrible place to live when your child's an addict because everybody has that perfect family, and I sure didn't. It was awful. But again, learning that yes, I can't control him. And when I say control, I could make it hard for him to use, but I couldn't take his desire away to use. But I tried really, really, really hard to do that to the point that I lost weight. I got cavities. I lost hair. I should have lost my job. You know, the owner of the company I work for was very understanding, but I'd spend my day trying to find out how to get him in rehab instead of doing my job. So I had, you know, the analogy is this. This is wonderful. Somebody at my group shared this. Your addict is out in a boat, out in a pond, and it's leaking. And they're sitting there doing nothing. So we row out there in our boat, and we're going to save them. So we start to bail the water out of their boat while they just sit there. Well, it's leaking faster than you can get the water out. So we're holding onto the boat and bailing it out, and the addict's just sitting there. And guess what? We both sink. So we have to learn to let go. And let go is an emotional detachment from the addict. While they're in active addiction, we do need to make sure they love them. The tough love analogy, that's kind of changed. It's not necessarily tough love, but it is love that's counterintuitive to most parents. We feel it needs to be done in a loving way. You know, they need to know they're loved, but I won't put up with their destructive behavior. And after my son burned every bridge and used everybody to the point that no one would help him was the day that he decided, I don't want this anymore. And it was he was in active addiction for 18 months and made the choice to stop and asked for help. And that's where we need to be healthy enough to understand, is he asking, are we really helping him now, or are we enabling him more? And he went into residential treatment after he had been to residential treatment and all kinds of other things prior. But nothing worked until he was ready. So he helped bail out that boat, and he got the boat righted. And it's all him. I give him all the credit. But again, we had to watch. The saying goes, "We love and pray for him."
It's got to be so frustrating as a parent, John.
It's more than frustrating. You know, it's your child. You know, and my wife was even worse. My poor wife. It's the strongest instinct she has is to care for her child. And her caring was allowing him to continue to use. So she had to get to the point where she said, well, this caring will kill my son. If I give him money and he goes out and uses that $10 to buy heroin and overdoses, I don't want to be responsible for that death. So she had to surrender. We use the term surrender. That doesn't mean give up. That means, you know, I'm not in control. My son or our addict has to follow the path, and until they've suffered the consequences and felt enough pain, and it's not just one event, it's that whole journey. You know, it wasn't the fact that, you know, that last piece. You know, he's overdosed. He's been dead. He had been revived 2-3 times. He's been in jail for 30 days. He's been homeless. He's been everything that an addict can be. But until the pain of using is worse than the fear of getting clean, he's not going to get clean, no matter what I do. But the Nar-Anon group is a place that I can go and say, my child got arrested last night. He's in jail. And instead of getting the gasp, oh, my God, well, you're a bad parent. Your child's in jail. They'll say, oh, he's safe. At least you know you can sleep tonight. That's a perspective that, unless you've gone through it, you just can't relate to.
John, why is that anonymous aspect of Nar-Anon? Why is that so important?
People are, they don't want people to know they have an addict. So when they come into the rooms of Nar-Anon, we want to be anonymous so that what's said there stays there. So that if we don't, we'll post it on Facebook. Somebody finds out, well, that parent has an addict. Oh my God, they might lose their job. You know, the social stigma of having an addict. People think addicts are that way because they're bad. And they're not. You know, it's a disease. Yes, they had to use. They had to use to some degree for that disease to kick in. But it's not a moral or ethical thing. What they do is immoral and unethical. They steal, they lie, they cheat, they do all of that stuff to use. But that person isn't bad. And that's a real tough nut for people to understand. I like to use type 2 diabetes as a good example. You're born with a genetic tendency for type 2 diabetes. How you live your life, how you exercise, how you eat, how you do those things, whether or not you do those a certain way, can turn that disease on. Were those decisions moral or character flaws? No. I could probably do the same thing. I could probably eat a little bit more, exercise a little bit less. And if I don't have the genetic tendency, I'm not going to turn that on. Well, the thing is, once that type 2 diabetes is turned on and the doctor tells the patient you have type 2 diabetes, how many of us go, I'm going to do exactly what that doctor tells me? Virtually none of us, unless something happens we either have
something pretty drastic.
Something
happens.
Pretty drastic, yeah. You know, so that makes us go, I better do something.
Walter and Latrice, I wanted to get your thoughts on John's story, because I think he touches on codependency,
yes.
Here, concerns about enabling.
Yes.
So let's talk. First off, what is codependency?
Well, it is enabling another person to be dysfunctional, whether that's in their relationships, in their addictions, or in their work ethics. And one of the things that parents must face, I think, is they themselves need help when there's an addict in the family. They need to get to where John is talking about, but most parents cannot get there unless they have help, because parents naturally confuse codependency with love. They believe they're loving their child by enabling the child, and to sort all that out, it's very important that they get help.
Mm-hmm. Latrice, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, and I would also like to add to that codependency and enabling are also two separate concepts. Mm-hmm. So when you think about enabling, it's more so the behaviors that are associated with, you know, enabling someone to continue to use drugs. So helping them cover up their use, or, you know, lying to their employer if they have to miss a day of work, for example, would be enabling. You can be enabled by a coworker, a loved one, et cetera. Whereas codependency refers to more of that relationship pattern. And so someone who is, you know, codependent, they can definitely enable someone to continue to use drugs. And so I think it's important to understand those two different concepts.
And John started to talk about how he personally how he physically was starting to suffer from this.
Mm-hmm.
And is that a sign that, that there's some codependency going on?
Oh, absolutely. That's definitely a symptom, I think, of codependency. And I also just want to point out, too, that it's a difficult concept, this whole thing of codependency, because it's kind of controversial within the literature, because this, you know, the idea of codependency really focuses on this idea of kind of blaming the other person. And I think that's kind of the issue at hand. So if there is, you do have a family member that's using, it's kind of like, well, I feel responsible in some kind of way. And so you alluded to some of that of like, well, what can I do? Or I'm in somehow in control of this.
One of the things where we see codependency is a child or an adult child gets in trouble with the law. The first thing most parents do is to get a lawyer and get him or her out of trouble. That is enabling.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of letting that child face the consequences of spending some time in jail. So that's a primary example of enabling. The parents rush in to rescue instead of letting the person face the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I agree. If I hadn't gone to Narnon and learned those aspects,
yes,
of enabling, we wouldn't have let him. That was our first decision, not to enable our son and to leave him in jail for 30 days.
Yes.
I mean, it's gut-wrenching. He's 18 mm-hmm. years old,
yes,
and he's in jail, and he was in another state, no less.
Mm-hmm.
But it's counterintuitive to parental instincts to do what would be helpful. You know, I know I can't cure my addict. I can't control my addict. But what I do does have influence on my addict,
mm-hmm,
if I make it easier for him to use or not.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that we have found in treating addiction is that many people who are addicted have underlying emotional problems. This often can be depression. It can be emotional dependency that they've never dealt with. And consequently, drugs or alcohol become a self-medication for those folks. And until somebody helps them understand that underlying hurt and trauma, in some cases, we have a separate program for women who are addicted. And what we find is virtually 100% of the women have been traumatized. Many, many times they've had sexual abuse as young girls, and that creates depression that then is relieved from using drugs or alcohol. So we have to treat the underlying issues, and addiction itself is a disease, as John said, but it also is a symptom of underlying emotional trouble.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. You can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Latrice, what are some other signs that codependency might be going on?
Sure. Well, when you think about this idea of codependency, it's important to remember that when you think of the definition, it's the over-involvement of being involved with someone who's addicted. And
so you feel like your feeling probably is that without you, that other person is going to fall apart.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So with that over-involvement piece, and also kind of this tendency to want to actually control the behavior of the person. And so you're doing what you can to kind of help enable that use. Also, feelings of low self-worth. There's been some literature that talks about that, and low self-esteem, where you're almost afraid to, you know, kind of set boundaries. Because really what it's about setting boundaries and clear, healthy boundaries with other people. And that you're afraid that if you set those boundaries and you say, no, I'm not going to pay your rent this time, or no, I'm not going to bail you out of this situation, that there's, you know, that there are some consequences to face from that, especially when you're talking about a loved one, you know, someone that is close to you. It's hard to kind of, quote unquote, cut them off. And so when you're having these feelings, these intense feelings of trying to figure out, am I, you know, where is that line of enabling versus helping a person? The first thing I tend to go to and think about is boundaries and setting those important boundaries and being assertive in that area.
Okay, so there's a very fine line between helping and enabling.
Mm-hmm.
Walter, would you expand on that a little bit? How fine a line is this?
Well, most of us love to rescue people. And a part of mothering is rescuing, a part of being a dad is rescuing. And so our rescue tendencies kick in when any of our family members are in trouble. And it's very difficult to control that urge to rescue and make it go away and to get the charges dropped with the criminal justice system and to say, well, it's okay that you didn't go to treatment. Maybe you'll go next week. So it's that struggle that parents have and loved ones have to get beyond their need to rescue, their need to fix it, because dads are famous for fixing things. They love to fix it. And this is one they cannot fix.
Yeah. And I'll add, by trying to fix it, you know, makes my life crazy. And it makes the relationship with the addict worse. And you say that my son started to use because he was depressed. You know, he does have clinical depression. He does take medication till this day, even 4 years clean. And he liked how he felt using. Now, I'm going to say not everybody that has mental issues have addiction, but those two combination pieces is disastrous. But what would happen is when I would get in his face and tell him all the things he was doing wrong while he was in active addiction, he knew, and Adam knew. Actually, I had to find a way to deal with having my son stealing, lying, doing all these terrible things that, you know, that's not the character of my son. So I actually named his disease. I named his disease something different than his actual name, so I could refer to, you know, I'm not going to put up with Luther's terrible actions anymore. And, you know, I love you, in my son's name, to my dying breath, but as long as Luther's in charge, you can't stay with us. And that helped some of his own mental issues, because when I would get on him, he would think, my dad hates me. We wouldn't articulate that, but his disease would say, your dad hates you. How do you like that? And it would drive him to use even more. Mm-hmm. So by letting him suffer these consequences and letting him find ways to have solutions, built his self-worth. And that was very pinnacle in his desire to continue to stay clean, his pride. We were robbing him of his self-worth by thinking we had the answers. And again, that goes counterintuitive to what you think.
Mm-hmm.
But how true is that? I mean, is what he's saying, it's valid?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that when we try to help, even though we're enabling, I think it doesn't work, because it does not deal with the depression. It does not deal with the underlying low self-worth. And until even parents can begin to do this, parents that get help then can in turn help their child deal with the depression. What is driving that? Now, we know sometimes depression is driven by chemicals in the brain, and sometimes it's driven by a sense of failure and grieving about something that's happened in life. But it's absolutely true. Parents can help the therapist if the parents are getting guidance to do that. And as John is saying, helping the addict to understand, it's not you. We love you, but your behavior. is going to result in consequences. But at the same time, we're going to say to the addict, tell me about you. You look sad at times. Let's talk about that. What are the roots of that? Now you're beginning to get underneath the addiction and deal with the emotional issues.
Well, Teresa, we're starting to talk about how do you effectively help someone who's addicted. What are some of your thoughts on this?
Well, one, you know, setting boundaries is extremely important. Mm-hmm. And so being very clear and assertive about, you know, okay, this is what I can do for you. I can listen. I can, you know, here are some specific things that I'm willing to do and help you with. However, I'm not willing to, you know, pay this bill for you or bail you out of this situation.
Same time, so I think, I'm going to stop at a certain
yes.
point. I'm not going to go any farther than this.
Yes, so being very clear with that. And then I think it's also just important to kind of, you know, step back and talk to them about, really talk to them about some of the issues that you're feeling. So even when I, you know, years ago when I was seeing clients, and one of the things that would come up is, you know, families being very clear about the reasons why they're engaging in the behavior that they are. So not only am I not going to bail you out, but here's what I'm thinking, and here are some potential solutions for you.
Yes.
So being very solution-oriented and being clear about why you're making the decision that you are, and that you know, it's definitely good for healthy relationships. And I would also say, just for families in general, even if you take addiction out of this context and just think about healthy relationships in general and kind of how you interact with people, you teach people how you want to be treated. And, you know, you should treat people in the way that you want to be treated. So I think in that same vein, thinking about, you know, and being very clear about, you know, the way that you want to interact with people and, again, setting those very clear boundaries with people, I think is extremely important. And being willing to have these open conversations, and they're difficult conversations. You know, I definitely acknowledge that, but I think it's just the first step to, you know, creating those healthy boundaries.
I participated in a documentary at NKU with students there who had become addicted. And one of the things that ran through every story was, and these were students in some cases who were making straight A's, but had gotten hooked on heroin. In virtually every case, the addict wanted to be somebody other than who he or she was. So it goes back to these underlying issues of being discontent, low self-esteem. And you'd think a person making straight A's would be okay with who I am, but that's not true with addicts. The one woman, 22, she talked about the first time she used heroin. She reached that pinnacle of feeling that she was something greater than who she was. But she never found that again. She chased heroin for 2 more years, but never again experienced that feeling of I am greater than who I am. So helping people accept who they are, dealing with low self-esteem, is so important in the addiction process.
And go ahead, Teresa.
And I just also wanted to add to that. I know we've been talking a lot about kind of the parent-child relationship, but also acknowledging that codependency can be like multi-generational. And so thinking about not just, you know, the way a parent and child might interact, but just thinking more globally about the family and about how, you know, if you think about, let's just say, like in your situation, you're talking about, you know, your son and you're a father, and thinking about how that might affect the other children or other family members that are around you, and setting those clear boundaries. So you're not only setting boundaries between yourself and the person who's using, but also kind of helping and teaching everyone else around you about the appropriate way to interact, because it's, you know, there's definitely research that suggests that these patterns can then carry over to other family members. And so, okay, if this person is engaging in enabling behavior, then it's like that's just what we're all supposed to do. You know, if he covers it up, then, you know, dad's covering up, so should your sister and your brother, and it becomes a part of what the family does. So I think it's important to also think about not just individually how it affects you, but also the family unit at large.
And we, in Naranon, I mean, we actually have literature, you know, addiction is a family disease, and we all play a part. And the siblings that aren't using get isolated. You know, we don't focus our time on them. We assume they're doing the right thing, and that's hurtful to them. Mm-hmm. So it really is a monster thing. But on boundaries, I agree, that is a big thing to do. But I also had to learn that the boundary was for me. Mm-hmm. As soon as I would set a boundary to try to influence the behavior of my addict, I would create an expectation that, you know, okay, you have to go to treatment or you have to do this. And I was expecting him to come out of treatment better. And then I would get disappointed. So the boundaries are more of an I statement now for us. And example, one boundary, a simple boundary, you know, sure, you can't use when you're in the house. But one was when he came back, you're not allowed to leave the house after I've gone to bed. And people go, well, that sounds like you're trying to control him. I said, no, it's not. Mm-hmm. What happens is when I would hear that door open, it would take me back to the post-traumatic stress event of when he was in active addiction. And I'd wake up in fear. And I don't care how mentally I was, you know, okay, this, I'm not afraid. It took me an hour or two to get back to sleep. So, you know, that boundary was for me. But I agree completely. Right. Setting, this is what we're going to do. And then having the courage to do that when the time comes. Mm-hmm. That's,
we're also pushing hard to get across the idea with politicians and policymakers that punishment in jail for long periods of time is not helpful. We must have treatment programs. I think sometimes spending 3 or 4 days in jail to think about it is okay, because my clinic gets a lot of referrals from drug court, and people are given the choice, jail time or treatment. And they try treatment, they can still choose jail time. And that use of jail, it can be therapeutic. But sending people away for out of the community for 6 months or a year is just not helping, and it's costly, and taxpayers cannot continue to afford to fund that.
We got an email from Vicki. She is asking, how does a parent weigh the harm of saying no to an addict and the chance they could end up on the street dead?
I can touch on that.
Yeah.
That's the fear. That's what cripples parents into continuing to enabling their addict.
Paralyzes.
It does. And the first step is realizing it's not your fault. When we realize that, you know, our child's use is their decision, so it's not our fault. And if, as I say, no matter how hard I would try to make it difficult for my son to use, I couldn't take his desire away to use. So I got to the point in my journey with my son, I had to face that hard question. Will I lose my son to this disease? And I got to a point where I said, if I have to lose my son, then that's his journey. But me trying to cover for him and take on all of his responsibilities was killing me. So I had to let him go. I did. And it's hard to tell. And we don't tell anybody. That's the beauty of Naranon. It's just a suggestion. You know, if you hear something here today that helps your heart, take it to heart. If you heard something you're not ready for or you don't like, forget about it. This is not a black and white subject. It's all gray. Mm-hmm.
John, Walter, and Latrice, thank you for being here this afternoon. We really appreciate it. Assistant professor in the Addiction Services Division of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience at the UC College of Medicine, Dr. Latrice Montgomery, President and CEO of Central Clinic Behavioral Health, Dr. Walter Smitson, and John, who wishes to remain anonymous. He's a member of the local group Naranon, and his son is an addict. And you can join us in the next segment as we discuss a major archaeological find that was found by some UC researchers in Greece, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.